Hello, my name is Susan Piver. Welcome to the Open Heart Project podcast. This month, our topic is the fierce power of vulnerability, and it's drawn from a talk I gave in New York City in late 2013. Has anybody heard, listened to the Brené Brown TED Talk on vulnerability? It's pretty good, isn't it? Yeah. I listened to it this morning for the first time, and I was like, yeah, that's a really good talk. And it was really, really wonderful. And I agreed so much with a lot of things that she said. So let me just start by asking you guys, what is a word that for you means vulnerability? Just give me a word. Open. Authenticity, tender, trusting, weak, shame. Exposed? Courage? Desperate? Well, that's a very interesting collection of words. Desperate and tender and courageous and open and authentic. Welcome to your life. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, the teacher who brought the Shambhala Buddhist teachings to the West, this is how he described vulnerability. He said, the only true elegance is vulnerability, which is quite an amazing thing when you think about it. I've been thinking about it all day. I just read that for the first time this morning. The only true elegance is vulnerability. Please think about that for the rest of your life. Starting right now. I know I will. And think about the times where you have been the most authentic, the most genuine. There is a kind of elegance about inhabiting your own being. All of these things are synonymous: genuine, authentic, vulnerable. And a kind of grace arises when you claim yourself. And there's always a kind of an awkwardness, an inelegance, when you're trying to be someone else or trying to be who you think you should be. Even if you really believe that's who you should be, you don't even quite know who you are. There's some unease inside that we all feel. And inelegant is a good way to describe it. So I went on my Facebook page this morning and I said, when do you feel the most vulnerable? And people said things like, I feel the most vulnerable when I have to tell someone that I don't like them anymore, or we're breaking up or something. I feel the most vulnerable when I have to express my ideas. I feel the most vulnerable when I want to tell someone I love them and I don't know how they feel about me. I feel the most vulnerable when I'm afraid. Interestingly, to me, all of those things had one thing in common. And does anybody have a guess of what that is? Fear, yes, fear. Fear of what?
Everything.
Everything. A little more specific. Uncertainty, rejection, honesty, fear of being seen. We're all so afraid to be seen. Yet, it is the thing that we long for. Beyond, beyond, and beyond, beyond. When we're seen, we come into being. Sometimes it takes someone else to see us in order for us to actually arise as ourselves. When we're seen, we fall in love. When we're seen, our lives make sense. And when we're seen, we are courageous. Doesn't mean you're seen as some glorious angelic being, just seen for who you are, with kindness and respect. So the thing that we're afraid of, I'm positing to you as my theory of today, is being seen. And it's the thing that we long for more than anything. Do you agree with me? Mm-hmm. We're only afraid of being seen when we feel ashamed of ourselves. When there's a root sense of unworthiness, we don't want anyone to see us. It's like, you know, when you look like crap and you haven't washed your hair and your clothes are dirty, you don't want to go outside, you don't want anyone to see you. You know, but when you feel like, okay, I've put myself together here, and I like my outfit, and I'm clean, and whatever it might be, then you feel like, yeah, okay, people could see me. But when we have this sense of who we are as being somehow unworthy, I don't know most of you, but I will say that 100% of us feel this way. Just unworthy. Tremendous doubt that who I am is okay. I mean, I don't want to sound too psychological about it, but this is a very, very profound problem. And I'm going to tell you why I think it's so profound. It's not just a psychological problem that we should try to fix, although, sure, it is a psychological problem, and we should try to fix it. But the implications of this problem go way beyond our personal lives. That's why I say I think it's the biggest problem in the world. Because when we are ashamed, when we feel unworthy, we numb out. We just don't want to deal with anything. We just try to numb out. Or, sort of conversely, we develop a very airtight philosophy that is like, this is the way things are, and this is what's right. We cling to certainty as a kind of shield. Or, when we feel ashamed and needy and so forth, we could become very grasping. Like, I need these things to feel okay, a relationship or this job or this outcome, this amount of money in the bank, and I cannot rest until I have those things, and all I can see is my own neediness. And then maybe once I get those things, I could maybe think about others, but I must have those things. When we're numb, we medicate. And medication can look like medicating, drugs, can look like rampant, insane entertainment without gap. And we all have that problem, I would say. Again, I don't know all of you, but there's the anxiety of constant entertainment, meaning a constant occupation for our minds, is so incredibly detrimental. And you know it when you're like, you get on the subway and you realize you forgot your phone, and you can't check your email 100 times, and you get very anxious. Like, what am I going to do? I mean, I have that too. I live in Boston, so I drive more than I take the subway, and if I forget my phone and I'm in the car, I kind of have this moment of, what am I going to do at a stop sign? It's horrible. Entertainment is how we numb ourselves. In a sense, some entertainment's good. I happen to like entertainment. When we cling to certainty, we have no choice but to become fundamentalist. Because if there's any gap in our certainty, it is too terrifying. And so we need everyone, I mean everyone, to toe the line. Otherwise, all hell could break loose. And this is the right way, and so forth. I don't need to explain to you what fundamentalism is. You know what it is. And then when you are consumed with grasping, you become very self-absorbed. This is my personal favorite, grasping, so I will represent for the self-absorbed people. Certainty, I don't have too much interest in. Numbness, I'm not too good at, but I'm really good at grasping. If we think of our world, I know I'm making a very big case here, but please go with me. If we think of the problems in our world, the sort of, I can't even find strong enough words to describe it, unreality of being constantly entertained, the inability to land in our lives or to see even humanity, because we are in an entertainment version of life rather than living our lives. So the disease of entertainment, the disease of fundamentalism, and the disease of selfishness are the problems our world faces right now. Are the things that create the problems in our world. That's why I say, and I'm not joking, that this is the most important topic in the world. Because when we're afraid to be vulnerable, we choose one or all of these solutions. In the Buddha Dharma, those solutions are called passion, aggression, and ignorance. Grasping, certainty, and numbness. So if these are the problems in our world, one could think then that if we reverse this whole thing, we could solve the problems in our world. And if what's at the root of these problems is unworthiness that gives rise to all these difficult things, then one can surmise that the solution lies in each of us feeling worthy. And I do feel quite fundamentalist about this, each of us feeling worthy. It starts with you, and you, and you, and you, and me. That's how important it is. There is no chance, I didn't come here planning to talk about the world, but there's no chance that any policy that we devise to create peace in our world will work if we who have to implement it don't feel worthy. So when we feel worthy, interestingly, we can be vulnerable. We can allow ourselves to be vulnerable because we aren't ashamed. We don't have to hide. Does that make sense? It's kind of like a weird formula, at least the way my mind works. It's a weird formula. So if instead of being numb, we were vital and living our lives and fully invested in our world, good, bad, and ugly, because it doesn't mean everything's going to be perfect, obviously, but if we lean into our world, experience our world, embrace our world, our lives, our problems, our joys, and so forth, if we can actually be alive rather than entertained, then that's a really good start. If we can let go of fundamentalism, we can be tolerant. If we can somehow put down our grasping for a moment, we can be compassionate. So if I would say that the solutions to our problems could be things like joy and tolerance and compassion. I think those would really help a lot. What does vulnerability have to do with all this? And the title of the program this weekend is The Fierce Power of Vulnerability. Not, you know, the wimpy, sappiness of vulnerability, but it's fierce. Do you know why? You do know why. I know you do. Why? Why is being vulnerable being fierce? Difficult. Yes. It takes courage. It's a path of warriorship. So, of course, we live in a world that is where we're accustomed to thinking that vulnerability is weakness. And what I would like to tell you is that vulnerability is power, and that it is only a coward who needs to walk through the world with a sense of invulnerability that is always falsely come by. Always. But a warrior, a fearless being, can be vulnerable. That is the fearless part. You can walk in unsheathed. There is no greater example of fearlessness than that. So, how? How do you do this? Because you can't just say, oh, vulnerability, that's my philosophy now. That's my attitude, and I'm always going to be vulnerable, because that won't work. So, and this was when I got to the end of the Brené Brown talk, which, again, I just love so much, and I just think that it was awesome, and she was so smart and funny and so forth. I thought it would be so great if at the end of this talk, where everybody, all 7 million people who watched it are like, yes, if there could then be something that was like, well, how? How do we do this? How do we embrace our vulnerability beyond going, yes, I will do it? Because, you know, you may walk out of the talk and say yes, but then, you know, someone dies, or someone takes your parking space. I mean, there can be a vast range of things that upset us. And then being vulnerable doesn't seem like such a good idea. You lose your job, or you get sick, or someone leaves you. And then being vulnerable doesn't seem like such a good thing. It's okay to be vulnerable when everything's fine. But we have to also learn how to be vulnerable when things are difficult. Because it's when things are difficult that we clam up and become selfish and fundamentalist and so forth. So we need a strategy for remaining vulnerable even when things are difficult. And this PS is my definition of fearlessness. It's the willingness and ability to remain open even in the face of very difficult circumstance. So how? Any guesses?
Practice.
Practice what? Meditation. All roads. My friends, all roads lead to one destination, and that is your butt on that cushion or chair. So I'm not just saying that because I'm a fundamentalist Buddhist, although I am. I'm saying it because if vulnerability isn't a philosophy or an attitude, it's a gesture that we each need to make from moment to moment. It's only in each moment that we can do this, that it counts. Doesn't count if you just think it's a good idea. How do we cultivate the ability to make this gesture over and over again of opening? And let me first explain for why, or offer some ideas why we would even want to do that, besides saving the world, which, okay, that would be cool, but I also would like to live my life and be happy. So, speaking of happiness, there is no love without vulnerability. That may sound cliche, but please think about it. Not the cliche bit, but unless you can open, where does the love go? And for most of us, many of us, without that opening, love becomes a contract that is based on specious terms. But with this opening, love, you can feel loved. And that's what we all want. I would feel pretty safe saying. If you have any interest in being creative, vulnerability is the prerequisite. Because there is no art without release of fixed mind. If you sit down to write or paint or make music or do whatever it is that you do for your art, and it could be gardening or parenting or whatever your art is, if you sit down to do it with an idea of what you're going to do, it's not art. It's some kind of a something else. It has no life. Art is something that arises in the moment that you bring forth. And it's something that you receive. And I'm going to say a little bit more about receiving in a minute, but there's no love without vulnerability. There's no art without vulnerability. And I don't mean just we like art. I mean your creative expression will not happen without vulnerability. And there's no joy without vulnerability because nothing can touch us. So, the good news and the bad news is we cannot open only to joy and art and love without also opening to sorrow and pain and loss. That's just our world. I don't know who designed it, but that's how it is. So you can't hold these things away and pull these things toward you. It's an all or nothing deal. So you could each ask yourselves, do you want to make that deal? I have absolutely decided I do. And some days I'm good at it and some days I'm not. But I'm trying to hold up my end of the bargain. But I can totally understand anyone who would say, I do not want to make that deal. But you should ask yourselves, do you want to? Are you willing to come out from behind whatever wall you've built? Not a rhetorical question. So think about it. if we sort of stop for a moment and think, oh, well, vulnerability is at the root of world peace and love and art and happiness, well, again, I say it's the most important topic in the world. And the reason that meditation is so powerful is because it teaches us first how to be with our own experience without judgment, or when there is judgment, without judging that. It teaches us how to be with ourselves from a place of expansiveness and allowing and curiosity, rather than judgment and criticism and analysis. And that's where worthiness comes from, according to this theory. Worthiness doesn't come from proving yourself worthy by accomplishing something or achieving something. Worthiness comes from recognizing your simple existence, and your existence is good, and that you are here is good, and that who you are is good. And you don't have to prove anything. And the Buddhist thought is that we're born good. Everybody, even Hitler. You know, that always comes up when you think this thought. Everybody's born good. And badness is a result of confusion. And it's sort of the opposite of the Judeo-Christian ethic that most of us were brought up in, which is everyone was born bad. And we have to work to become good. Everyone's born good. It creates a lot more hope for this world. If we trust our own goodness, we can trust the goodness of others. And when we trust the goodness of others, we can relate with them and care about them. So I hope I don't sound too proselytizing or moralistic, but anyway, so in meditation practice, we practice sitting with our experience, feeling it, noticing it, when it's gone, letting it go without trying to hold on. And that's very useful. That's the foundation of a good relationship to yourself. It's kind of like you're making friends with yourself rather than always admonishing yourself. And it also teaches the art of openness. And anyone who is a meditator knows this, because somehow, for some mysterious reason, the longer you practice, the more you notice how tender-hearted you are, and the more things touch you. So you may think when you start to meditate, well, I'm going to become kind of implacable. But actually, your meditation practice softens your heart, and things touch you more, as I say. So an opening arises through your practice, because your fixed mind is kind of loosening its grasp on everything. That's one explanation. The real reason is a mystery. I don't know why it has that effect, but it does. So it teaches us how to be friends with ourselves. It acquaints us with this feeling of opening from moment to moment to moment, so that when we can do it on the cushion, we can do it off the cushion. And finally, and this is the last thing I want to say before, if you have questions or thoughts, that would be great. When we talk about the things that are best, that we love the most about being alive, being inspired, being loved, being happy, these are things that we receive. They are not things that we can crank up or will or acquire. To be inspired is to receive something, right? I mean, you can certainly create the circumstances for inspiration to arise by whatever it is you do, but nonetheless, it's something that comes to you. It's something that arises. It's something that you receive. Love, of course, is something that you receive. And joy is something that you receive. Receptivity is an undervalued strength in our society that really values going out and getting things. I don't know what the word is, opposite of receptivity. But being receptive is the root of insight and intuition and so forth. So if you're interested in those things, it's good to cultivate a space of receptivity. And these things arise. Where do they arise from? Because again, anyone who meditates knows that it's not just a practice of mindfulness and precision. It's a practice of spaciousness and awareness. Because while you're cultivating focus, your mind opens. Meditation is sometimes called the practice of clear seeing or the practice of insight. So it's both mindful and aware. What I will suggest to you is that when you're sitting on your cushion and you are focused on your breath, and then you space out and you are thinking about something, and then somehow you realize, oh, well, I'm thinking about something. I'm supposed to be focused on my breath. That moment is very interesting. Because where does this come from? Oh, wait, you're supposed to be focused on your breath. Where does that come from? And if that was there all the time, why can't you just do that anyway? Why can't you just hold your focus on your breath? Something happens and then something cuts through and says, wake up, look at where you are, please go back. So I will suggest that this, wherever this cutting through comes from, in the Shambhala lineage, we call it the stroke of Ashe. But wherever this cutting through comes from is also the place that inspiration comes from, and intuition, and a connection to the more tender feelings. Becoming accustomed and recognizing the cutting through is very useful. And it is kind of magical.